Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. It is the big Super Bowl weekend, but along with the Super Bowl and all the ancillary stuff that you're going to be doing this weekend for that, there's also some movies out you might want to check out in between your runs for chicken wings and beer and pizza for the big game. We're going to be talking about those movies, including Project Almanac, The Loft, Black Sea, Black or White, and of course, the Oscar shorts, one of my favorite bits that comes out of the Oscars every year. There's also some news talking about a female cast of Ghostbusters and a possible new Indiana Jones movie. The Trailer Park is coming up, as well as box office predictions and the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, before we get to that, if you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, if you want to find me on Twitter and hit me up that way, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's move into the news. We're actually slowing down on the news. Not so much contentious political debate over American Sniper and who's a propagandist or not. We're going to dial it back a little bit. Still actually talk about something that maybe hits a couple political hot buttons. But before we get to that story, which involves the Ghostbusters, I want to talk a little bit about Chris Pratt. He is being, let's just say, explored as the new Indiana Jones. Of course, Disney is working on getting a new Indiana Jones franchise kicked off. Harrison Ford's, 86 years old, so he really can't do that anymore. If you recall from the last Indiana Jones movie, which was 7 years ago now, that was back in 2008, that one starred Harrison Ford, but it also brought in Shia LaBeouf as a obvious guy he's going to pass the reins to. Well, then Shia LaBeouf went completely insane. Now they're looking at rebooting it. Now that, of course, Lucasfilm has become more solvent under Disney, and they're looking at getting a new Indiana Jones, and they're looking at Chris Pratt. I kind of have mixed feelings about this, because on one hand, I love Chris Pratt. I think he's very, very funny. I think he's great on Parks and Rec. I think he was fantastic in Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm looking forward to Jurassic World. I thought he was awesome in the Lego movie. He's not quite Indiana Jones, though. I would be okay with a reboot. I just hope it's not too Chris Pratt-y. And that's a little bit odd, because I really enjoy watching the guy on screen. So I'm mixed on this one. I still don't know if it's going to quite work, but that's, of course, yet to be seen. And of course, you got to worry about who's directing it and who's writing it. I think Spielberg and Lucas are so far beyond that the reins need to be passed to new people. The other big casting decision that the news that really kind of came out and went bonkers this week was the female cast of Ghostbusters was announced. Now, we all knew this was coming because Paul Feig, who is going to be directing it, had come out a while back and said he was going to go for a female cast. And what's funny is, for as much as there's been talk this year about how women are underrepresented in Hollywood and they don't have the power, there was a real mixed reaction to the Ghostbusters idea of a female cast. And I don't want to get sort of trapped in the thing of sounding like a sexist, because I don't really think the people that are bothered by this are coming at it from a, well, women can't be Ghostbusters kind of respect. I think people are looking at it as a question of stunt casting, where you just do something different to have something different to make it a buzz to worry about. I talked about this a couple weeks ago with a black James Bond concept. Idris Elba. I think Idris Elba would be a fantastic James Bond, but I'm not looking for a black James Bond. I'm looking for James Bond, and get the right guy to play him. If he happens to be black, great. And I think Idris Elba could be a really good James Bond. I think Will Smith would be a lousy James Bond. Doesn't matter whether you're black or white, it matters on whether you can play the role. And stunt casting is when you're casting somebody just for the buzz. And I think bringing in an all-female cast of the Ghostbusters, it feels like doing Little Archie. It feels like saying, oh, we're going to do Ghostbusters, but it's going to be girls now. And then, of course, there's the overbearing sexist attitude that it's like, well, we're going to cast females in the leads, but you still need the guy to direct it, of course. because, you know, women, you can't possibly direct a movie. So I think that there's a certain level of disingenuousness to this entire process that Paul Feig loves casting women, but he's still a guy directing the movie. But ultimately, you're getting Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy, who a lot of people have been rumoring were going to be in this movie because they were both in Bridesmaids, which is kind of really what put Paul Feig on the map as a feature director. And of course, Melissa McCarthy was in The Heat. My biggest beef is I don't want it to just become a rehash of The Heat. Because I hated The Heat. And I don't want Melissa McCarthy just to be her obnoxious self, which I'm fine with her doing some slapstick, but I think she's way more talented than people give her credit for, which is why her character in Bridesmaids and her character in The Heat and her character in Tammy and her character in Identity Thief are all pretty much the same. And then when she's not playing that role, she's playing the somewhat meek, adorable, yet out of her depth kind of mother type, which she played in St. Vincent. And she was good in that movie, but she can do so much more. She can do more than those two roles, and she's not given that opportunity. And then Kristen Wiig and Paul Feig, if you go look at Bridesmaids, it doesn't feel like that's what the Ghostbusters should be. There was a certain sort of kismet when they did Ghostbusters back in the 80s. You had this sort of Stripes reunion where you had Ivan Reitman and Harold Ramis and Bill Murray, and they brought in Dan Aykroyd, another huge actor who had an entire career on his own at the time. It was this coming together, this meeting of minds, as opposed to just stunt casting. But the other thing, the other two women in it, Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live, nobody else knows who they are. Again, it doesn't feel like you're taking three great comedians, which was Harold Ramis, Bill Murray, and Dan Aykroyd. You're taking Kristen Wiig, who's had a spotty career recently, and Melissa McCarthy, who can play a one-note character, and then two people from Saturday Night Live you've never heard of. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Got two to talk about really quick this week. The first one is the reboot of Fantastic Four by Josh Trank, who did Chronicle. The new trailer is out, and let's just say the reactions were mixed.
How did we get this far? Human beings have an immeasurable desire to discover, to invent, to build.
Ready for what's coming.
What is coming?
The answers.
The problem that I have with this trailer is it doesn't really give you a sense of anything but the cinematography. It doesn't give you a sense of the acting. It doesn't give you a sense, any sense of story. It doesn't give you any sense of what's happening. And a lot of the shots look like they came from all other trailers. I mean, you can see The Dark Knight in there. You could see Star Trek in there. You could see Looper in there. You could see Super 8. I mean, you could see all these things that just looks very derivative of a lot of other things that we've seen. And we get no sense of really anything. It looks cool, but then I guess that's what a teaser is supposed to do, but it's extremely deceptive. It looks like there's a lot of stuff in there, but there really isn't. And I'm coming from as a guy who liked those Tim Story movies. I thought the Fantastic Four from 2005 was a lot of fun. I'm a fan of those movies. They captured the campy 60s essence of Marvel Comics, and everyone has to, oh, it has to be dark and serious and go back and read some of the stuff from the 60s. It's not dark and serious. It's campy and goofy. And gee whiz, Stan Lee dialogue. So I don't know. I'm still holding out reservation for Fantastic Four. It opens in August, August 7th. That also kind of makes me a little nervous. The other one I wanted to hit really quickly is Ted 2, which opens on June 26th.
Oh my God, Teddy, look at this. It says if we want to have a baby, y'all going to have to prove you're a person in a court of law.
This is a nightmare.
We got to fight it. We'll get a lawyer and we'll sue the government for your civil rights.
I'm Samantha Jackson. It must be Ted.
Yeah, Samantha Jackson. What's your middle name?
Leslie.
Oh my God, you're Sam L. Jackson.
That's great. I mean, just like Sam L. Jackson.
Who is that?
You ever seen any movie ever? He's the black guy.
This one looks funny, I have to admit. It looks very much in line with Ted 1. My only concern with this one is it just seems to be kind of a Porky's 2 story where it's like trying to swerve into some interesting issues of what makes you human and adoption, and which is very Seth MacFarlane. Seth MacFarlane will make these stories that have greater implications and have a bigger political statement, but then he'll just throw in a fart joke. If it's going to be a funny movie, great. I can't wait to see it. If it's trying to make a message, then I don't know. Do we really need that in a movie about a sexually active teddy bear? Anyways, with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the not really new, but new movies, Black Sea and Black or White. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews for this segment, because we've got a bunch of them. We've got four new movies with trailers, and then we've got the Oscar shorts to talk about in the final segment. So there's plenty of options out there. This is the black segment. Both movies have black in the title. The first one is Black Sea. A group of former submarine crewmen rent a rogue vessel to search for a sunken Nazi treasure at the ocean floor beneath the Russian Navy.
One of Hitler's U-boats is just sitting on the seabed. Full of gold. I need men. Half British, half Russian.
How much gold we talk?
$182 million. Equal share, every man.
What happens when one of them starts to figure out that their share gets bigger and there is less people to share it with?
This is directed by Kevin MacDonald, not Kevin MacDonald from The Kids in the Hall, for those of you who are fans. It is Kevin MacDonald, the guy who directed The Last King of Scotland, so a much more serious, gritty director. It's a submarine movie, and you know, I like a good submarine movie. We get some are good, some are bad. I mean, like, what, last year or two we had Phantom, which was an okay submarine movie, but I mean, it's not like the classics like Das Boot or movie, even like U-571, as popcorn as that was still an enjoyable submarine movie. What's neat about this film is a lot of movies are presented in a way where you're like, well, why would they be just so stupid to do XYZ? These are smart people. Why are they doing this? And in this movie, you've got this guy who takes a bunch of unstable, emotionally crippled Brits and Russians, crams them together in a tin can, sinks them to the bottom of the ocean, and of course it's going to be a disaster. But you know what? This thing makes sense, because they're on a timetable. They have to kind of go with rogue people. They can't get people who are working in the submarine industry already. So it kind of makes sense that they would make such a bad decision of putting all these people together in the same boat and watching the insanity and the danger ensue. And that's kind of what makes Black Sea work, is because it is like a lot of movies full of people making terrible decisions. But these are decisions that seem extremely realistic given the situation we're presented. And I realized when I was watching the movie, the biggest challenge with a submarine film is if you make the whole thing take place in a submarine. Now, if you're doing something like Hunt for Red October, where the submarine's the size of a, you know, of Manhattan, it's a little easier. You've got a lot of set to work with. But this is a small Russian submarine. It's very rustic. It's very metal. And it's not a whole lot of unique scenery. But I realize as I'm watching the movie, I'm like, we haven't left the boat. The only time you leave the boat is when they actually go diving looking for the other boat that they need to find, the other U-boat. And it works. It works in a suspense sort of way. The characters are all flawed in very many ways. They're all damaged people, but they're not all ubiquitously unpleasant. There are some that are more unpleasant than others, and there are some that you know are kind of insane. But it works, and it puts them in a very dangerous situation. And it puts the characters in a setting that it feels claustrophobic, not to the detriment of the film. Very well directed. So some really good acting, especially by Jude Law. Scoot McNairy has a really good role in this as well. And it works. It has a couple trite moments in terms of reveals and surprises. But overall, I mean, I really enjoyed Black Sea. I think that that's one. If you haven't had a chance to, you want to see something different. It's not an action movie like Hunt for Red October was, but it's more of a suspense thriller, kind of a, people at each other's throat at the bottom of the ocean in a steel trap. So I'm going to say Black Sea kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Black or White. Kevin Costner stars as an alcoholic who fights for the custody of his mixed-race granddaughter after both her mother and his wife pass away.
This is Eloise. She's my granddaughter.
What are you doing?
I want to make pancakes. Set the table, please.
My wife and I raised her after my daughter died. Then life threw us a curve, and now her grandmother's gone, too.
You got a plan for Eloise in light of all this?
You tied it like a tennis shoe.
It's got a whole lot of family down with me.
I'm thinking we need to start talking about a shared custody.
Not gonna happen.
She has a father.
You live in a blind spot when it comes to your son. He's a junkie.
And you're a drunk!
This movie got a push at the end of last year for award season, and I actually had a chance to see it back in December. Because it was they were really pushing to see if we can get Kevin Costner nominated for something or the writer-director, Mike Binder. If you saw The Upside of Anger, which was about 10 years ago, that was also by Mike Binder, and it starred Kevin Costner. I hated that movie. I think it made my top 10 worst of the year list. And part of the reason I didn't like that movie is it was supposed to be about anger, but it muddled the whole thing together with him being an alcoholic. And it became more about the upside of alcoholism than about anger issues and romance, which is what the movie was ostensibly about. And this movie is supposed to be raising some racial issues. There are real debates that go on in the courts of people wanting custody of a kid. And the reason being given, these things have shown up, where the reason being given, they say, well, because of the kid's race. If the kid's half black, then that should weigh more into the decision to award custody to one family or the other, which is nonsense. Anyways, I mean, I understand, you know, you need to have, pride in your heritage and you need to have an identity with your family, but that should not be the consideration. It should be the safety and well-being of the kid, not the color of the kid's skin. But it's a real issue. And I think that there's a real issue to be examined here. But then it then becomes more about Kevin Costner's character's alcoholism, which I don't know what Mike Binder's obsession is with alcoholism. But it's kind of annoying and unnecessary, especially in a film like this, where it could really do it. And plus, it makes him into a part of what also cheesed me off about this movie is it's supposed to be that question, you know, should someone be granted custody of a child simply because of the child's skin color and their skin color and heritage and it makes them work better for their, family relationship? And that's really what it should be examining. But then it turns into, well, Kevin Costner's character, he is kind of a racist and he uses the N-word and he is kind of a pig and he is kind of a jerk. And you're watching this movie and going, well, I don't think he'd be very good at raising this kid. So there are some interesting points to consider in a movie like Black and White. And it reveals a couple things. They're good conversation starters. But for a movie that's supposed to be examining racial issues, it really just spends most of its time examining alcoholism and abuse and just contentious upstairs downstairs kind of social strata and limits. And I give them credit for making the movie. I think it was a good effort and its heart's in the right place, but it's not a great movie. And there's a reason it didn't get a ton of nominations, even though they tried. Kind of reminds me of Cake, which we talked about last week, where it was really going for that award push, and it didn't really get much. I mean, Cake at least got a Golden Globe nomination for Jennifer Aniston or something. I don't think Costner got anything for this outside of just like smaller groups. That's it. Black or White is out there, but I have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the brand new movies for this weekend in January. That's a mark of quality. Project Almanac and The Law.
We'll be right back.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the new segment with some movie reviews. If you know anything about movies, January is not considered a powerhouse month. Most January releases, most of the big grossing movies you get in January are either sort of like very niche genre or to a limited audience, something like Ride Along did very well in January. Or their spillover from December, you know, when Avatar, both James Cameron, Avatar and Titanic both were topping the box office, and they opened in December, but they continued to top the box office in January. If you're watching trailers and it's sometime in the fall and you see the trailer and it's like this January, you know, it's a bad movie or it's got a good chance of being a bad movie. So I'm not exactly being subtle here as I'm getting ready to talk about the movies this week, the brand new ones. The first one is Project Almanac. A group of high schoolers stumble onto plans for a time machine and discover that changes to the past can have severe consequences. Who would have thunk?
Here we go, Project Almanac. Temporal relocation prototype?
What does that mean?
It means time travel.
We should try to build it.
You guys are crazy. We can't build a time machine.
Did you see the tape? I mean, I think we already did build it.
All right, you guys ready for this?
Are you seeing this? Whatever we did had some crazy ripple effects.
There was a plane crash, riots, disasters. None of this happened before.
Things are spiraling out of control.
I'm all for time travel movies. And I'm all for high school time travel movies. I thought Back to the Future was a lot of fun. 30 years ago, great movie. Project Almanac swerves into some interesting ideas, like once you get 70 or 80 minutes into the movie. But the big thing that keeps it down is the thing that keeps a lot of these movies down. It's found footage. I feel like a broken record because I've said this every time a found footage movie comes out. It's an overused, uncreative genre. So you either do one or two things with a found footage movie. You're either justifying why somebody's filming something all the time, and you have to remind everybody every 10 minutes, or you're just ignore the fact that somebody's filming stuff all the time, and you're like, why are you creeping out and like sneaking around corners? Why are you filming? And so neither one works, because you're either spending too much time justifying it, or it just doesn't seem to work why somebody would film something without some sort of psychosis. And now we've got found footage spilling over from the horror genre, which is where it was mostly seen, into the sci-fi genre. And we saw that with Chronicle, which I know Chronicle did well, and people like Chronicle. I didn't. I'm well documented as to how much I didn't like Chronicle. But last year we had that movie, Earth to Echo, that came out right around 4th of July. And Earth to Echo was a charming little idea, an Amblin throwback, sort of an homage to all those Steven Spielberg movies of the 80s. But by making it found footage, it just ruined it. Part of the thing with found footage, you feel like you're boxed in. You feel like you're looking at it from a shoebox because you're just thrown around the scenes and there's no scope to a found footage movie. It was, Cloverfield had some scope, but it was still felt like it was boxed in because it was told from a camera's point of view, just a handy cam kind of view. And that's the problem with Project Almanac. The other thing is it thinks it's really smart. And we've talked about this before where, you know, like Lucy was a movie last summer that a lot of people said, well, it thinks it's smart, but it's really a dumb movie. Well, what's wrong with it being a dumb movie? It's a dumb action movie. But it deals with some higher concepts. I mean, for that matter, Inception thinks it's very smart, and it's not. There's a lot of movies that think they're smart, and they're really not, because they're being made science fiction movies for a mainstream audience, and anybody who is immersed in science fiction has read these high concepts and seen these high concepts before. So it's always seemed dumbed down. This one's dumbed down almost to an embarrassing level. For example, they need to get fuel for this. So they, we need hydrogen. So we're going to go to the school and steal the hydrogen that the school has. Forget the fact that you can just electrolyze hydrogen out of water off the tap. They had to go get hydrogen. But I'm like, you don't just use standard hydrogen for fusion, which is what runs this machine. You gotta level it out, and you gotta get heavy water. You gotta use deuterium and tritium, and that's how you use it. And that's the rare stuff. You don't have that stuff lying around a school. You don't have nuclear materials lying around a school. Yet somehow they have just these little containers of hydrogen that are somehow powering this whole. It makes no sense, and it tries to justify the science, and it just fails miserably. And then when I went back and I watched the trailer, I realized in watching the trailer that they violate everything that the movie does. Now remember, like in the Terminator movies, the first Terminator is all this loop. It's this whole loop because if he doesn't send back Kyle Reese, he can never be his dad, and it all fits in this very locked timeline. But when they got to Terminator 2, it violates that. And I understand that those movies were, you know, what, almost 10 years apart, and they had to extend the story. Okay, so you violate one little time thing. But this one does it in the movie itself, where it says, where it kind of says, oh, you can change the past, but really what started them down this path is the fact that they see what happens at the end, and it's just, you're either in this closed loop or you're not. And it just, it's sort of like kids playing in the backyard going, oh, let's do this now. Let's say we can, I can fly now. And, oh, I'm bulletproof. You know, you can't kill me. That's sort of the way they make this movie. It makes no sense. And then they have these, oh, we have a paradox, but they don't explain what it does. And the outcome of the paradox is either explained away as, I don't know, it's just something bad happened, or just something happens that has no basis whatsoever of why this would happen. It just seems like something cool to happen. I mean, it's like written with the high concept of a 5-year-old. So Project Almanac, it's a crappy found footage movie that if it had spent more time coming up with a plot that worked and characters that made sense, it would have been a decent movie. But no, it spends all its time being a found footage teen angst film, and it's crap. So Project Almanac sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I'm going to be talking about is The Loft. 5 friends share a downtown loft for sexual trysts, and they discover a dead woman inside and are grilled by police. If I had a nickel for every time that happened to me, good Lord.
Welcome to The Loft. Our own private oasis.
No messy hotel bills. No questionable credit card activity.
Accepting a key to the loft means you accept the rules to the loft. Tell nobody.
Have fun.
Do you know who she is?
Of course not.
We gotta call the cops.
Think about our wife. There's a dead woman here, Vince.
All right, this one is meant to be a thriller, and it's got this soundtrack that really, really, really thinks it's a Hitchcock movie. I mean, to the point, there's like scenes where they're at a party, and they're, and it's got this really heavy strings, you know, kind of psycho soundtrack, and you kind of have to sit back and be like, nothing exciting's happening in this film. Part of the problem with this movie is it's convoluted. That and the fact that I don't like any of the characters. They're all cheating jerks. Or idiots. And there's nobody to root for in the movie. You don't root for the husbands who are cheating on their wives. You don't root for the girlfriends because they're all vapid idiots. You don't root for the wives because they're all kind of caustic pariahs. Nobody's a pleasant person. You don't want anyone to win. You got all these guys, they're arrested at the end, or they're arrested at the beginning because it's all told in flashbacks. So they're all arrested at the beginning. And you're like, well, I don't care if they go to jail. I don't care if they did it or not. And it's kind of like Project Almanac. It seems to make stuff up as it goes along. And then it's told in flashbacks, but then it has flashbacks within the flashbacks. And it's hard to keep track of what's actually happening. And you're trying to keep track of what they're telling the cops and what they're not telling the cops. What's them telling the story? Cause you know, when somebody, well, we went here, we did this, and then they flash back to this, and then more things happen. And I'm like, well, they can't be telling the cops this. Is this backstory now? I mean, who knows what? And it's not very well put together. I like Carl Urban. I like James Marsden. But then it has some really bad acting. And then Rachel Taylor, and she's okay. She's skinny. She's very pretty, and she was really attractive in the first Transformers movies, you know, like 8 years ago. But that's because she had to, like, actually get some meat on her bones. But here she's, like, anorexic, and she's... And then they have Isabel Lucas, who was also in a Transformers movie, and she's Skeletor-looking. Her face, she just looks there, and she is not a good actor. To a extreme degree. And Wentworth Miller, who plays one of the guys, he's from Prison Break, he has a moment of acting toward a force that's laughable that I giggled noticeably in the movie. This is not a good film. It is perfect for a January release. It reminds me of films like Dead Man Down, that one with Noomi Rapace a couple of years ago, or Broken City with Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe. These completely, utterly forgettable January releases that are supposed to be gritty and hardcore, and they're really just boring. You'd expect to see this on a made-for-Showtime movie from the 90s. Not very good. So I have to say The Loft... It sucks.
It sucks.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Oscar shorts, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, finishing up the show. We got still a couple more things to talk about. I want to talk about the Oscar short, so we don't have a trailer for this because there's literally 15 movies involved in this. If you watch the Oscars every year, there's always, or if you download a ballot so you can do a little guessing who wins, there's always the short films, and there's 5 animated films, there's 5 live action films, and 5 documentaries. And you all may wonder, where do you get a chance to see those? Because when I was a kid, I remember when I was younger, you never got to see those. They'd mention them in the ceremony. They might give them as a pre-taped thing. I love short films anyways. I'm a huge fan of short films. I think it's a lost art in many respects. If I ever go to a film festival, I always try and check out the shorts programs because it's a great way to sample a bunch of new filmmakers. And there's some pretty innovative stuff that's happening in short films. And there are 3 categories. There's the animated short films, there's the live action short films, and then the documentary short films. Very much like regular old long films. Long feature films, I guess you could say. And in recent years, they have packaged these together and released them into theaters. And the Oscar shorts are going into, I think it's something like 400, 500 theaters this weekend. So if you're in a big city or near a big city or a marginally large city, you can usually find at least one theater in town that's showing them in several different blocks. They have the there's 4 blocks, at least in my local theaters, there's 4 blocks. There's the animated block, the live action block, and then they split the documentary into 2 separate blocks because those tend to be longer films, 40 minutes or 50 minutes sometimes. And if you don't like one of them, a new one's going to start in about 10 minutes. So even if you don't like one of the short films, you don't have to slag through 2 hours. You may only have to, at most, you're going to have to slag through 40 minutes. Of course, my favorite of the short films is the animated block. Disney always has an entry in it. They had Paper Man, and usually it's a Pixar movie, but this one is Feast, which is Disney animation, and I believe it was ahead of Big Hero 6. Charming little film about a dog and his master. But there's other ones in there. There's one called Me and My Molten, which is a story of this kid from Norway, and just sort of this stream of conscious telling about her life. And it's an interesting look. It's rudimentary throwback animation to the 70s. There's a movie called The Bigger Picture, which is about 2 brothers trying to deal with the end of their mother's life. There's one called The Dam Keeper, which is about a pig that keeps a dam from pouring over. But he's getting bullied at school, and it deals with other issues. And it's actually a very rich movie that has no dialogue to it, but has some rich, thoughtful ideas to it. And then A Single Life, which is my favorite, about a woman who finds a record player that can be used as a time traveling device. A way better time travel film than Project Almanac ever was. So that's an interesting one. And I think a lot of the theaters are going to, buffer it up with a couple other short films. You might get 4 or 5 other short films, animated movies, because the animated ones tend to be short, about 10 minutes or less, maybe. I think the longest one is The Dam Keeper, which is just under 20 minutes. The live action, if you can't handle subtitles, you got to deal with that in these films, because some of them come from foreign markets. In the live action category, you've got Parnava, which is a movie about a girl who's from Afghanistan in Switzerland trying to go send money back home and sort of an adventure that she has in the city. There's Boogaloo and Graham, which is a story of these kids who have this pet chicken and how they deal with it in Northern Ireland. It's very cute and sweet. There's one called Aya, which is a movie about a woman who literally picks up a person at at the Ben Gurion airport in Tel Aviv and drives him to Jerusalem. And she's not really his driver, but it's just this weird sort of take your chances type movie. There's one called The Phone Call. That one's pretty intense, about Sally Hawken plays a woman who's taking a crisis line call from a man who's committing suicide. And then Butterlamp, which is a movie in Tibet about taking photography of families against backdrops in a beautiful area, but putting them in more traditional tourist spots. It's a little more avant-garde, I guess you could say. Then there's a documentary program. It's split into two different programs. Now, the documentary program, I'm not wild about. It tends to be heavy on the misery this year because it deals with some pretty heavy issues. Like one of them called Our Curse is dealing with this family who's got a baby who's got a chronic disease, of a chronic breathing disease. And there's another one called Joanna about a woman who's dying of cancer. So you get the heavy stuff. If you want to cry and you want to deal with the emotion, you can go check out the documentary programs. They're in two different blocks. The Oscar shorts, definitely worth checking out. If you can find them in your local area, it's always worth checking out for those. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next, let's talk about the box office, who won. Last week, I said that American Sniper was going to win the box office. I was right. I said it was going to make only $45 million. It made $64 million. Here's what's so significant about that. It reminds me of when the Avengers came out and made $200 million its first weekend, which was the first time a movie has made $200 million domestically on opening weekend. The second weekend, it made over $100 million. Now, there's been plenty of movies that have made over $100 million opening weekend, but there's never been anyone that's made $100 million on its second weekend. American Sniper beat the January box office record in its opening weekend with close to $100 million over the 3-day. It beat the January box office weekend in its second weekend, which was in the 50s. It made $64 million. If all American Sniper did was make $64 million its opening weekend, it'd still be a monster hit. This movie's a juggernaut. It's insane. It made, more than four times as much as The Boy Next Door, which was the second highest movie, which made almost $15 million, which for as entertaining as the movie was, as bad as it was still entertaining. I don't know how many people saw The Boy Next Door for a serious piece of filmmaking, but it worked, you know, and Jennifer Lopez isn't going to make more than $15 million on her opening weekends, but it's good for movies like this. Then Strange Magic came in at number 7 with $5.5 million. Mordecai came in at number 9 with 4.2. And there's all these stories about, is Johnny Depp's career as a movie star over? He's never been a movie star. I mean, he's been a name. He's been a recognizable name. But outside of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and some of the Tim Burton films like Alice in Wonderland, the guy isn't a draw. People don't see movies to see. I mean, there are people who see movies to see Johnny Depp, but he's not a bankable name. There is a virtual minefield of bombs and movies that didn't do well that starred Johnny Depp. So this is not a surprise, and I don't think it's boding poorly for Johnny Depp's career. If people were casting Johnny Depp because they thought he was going to bring in box office, they're dumb. And they deserve to lose money on opening weekend. I think that this movie got made because David Koepp has a lot of power and knows a lot of people. He was able to get a great cast. And I mean, the same thing with like Gwyneth Paltrow, she's in it. Is everyone saying her career's over? No, because Gwyneth Paltrow's never been a huge draw. I mean, her biggest grossing movies are the Avengers movies because she just happens to play Pepper Potts in them. But that's why she's in $300 million movies. Because she was in Iron Man, in Iron Man 2, and Iron Man 3, and the Avengers. You know, Johnny Depp is fine. I wouldn't start worrying about Johnny Depp's career. Mordecai did not do well, but it was never going to do well. No one sees movies for Johnny Depp. It's in less than the Pirates movies. And that's just the way it is. You know? And I don't think Johnny Depp cares. I don't think Johnny Depp cares that no one sees the movies for him. I think Johnny Depp doesn't give a crap about the box office of Mordecai. I think he was just having fun making the movie. So that's it about box office. This week, I think American Sniper is going to win again. I really don't think there's anything that has any sort of enough power to do it. I mean, Project Almanac might have a good show simply because teens are dumb and they like found footage movies. But recently, found footage has been really struggling. And that's good because it's crap. But that might do well. I think The Loft's going to crash and burn. Nobody's going to see it. And I think I really don't see Black and White doing terribly well or Black Sea. All these movies are very limited releases. Plus, you got the Super Bowl. It's going to be a lower end weekend. And yeah, people are going to be seeing movies on Saturday and Friday. But Sundays, look, if you really want to see a movie with a small audience, go on Sunday during the Super Bowl. You'll have the room to yourself. And because of all that, I'm going to guess $30 million for American Sniper, which is still good for an opening weekend in January. It's third weekend. listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. And that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. First up, we've got Fury, which is the World War II tank movie with Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf. I liked that, aside from one scene, which I thought got a little rapey, but that's just me. The Judge, which I wasn't a big fan of, but it's Robert Downey Jr. going for an Oscar bid, and it got made because Robert Downey Jr. is a big name now. And Robert Duvall, I think he got an Oscar nomination for that. I mean, he does fine, but he's kind of playing Robert Duvall. Then there's The Book of Life, which is a very charming, innovative, animated film that came out in October. Neat look at the Mexican Day of the Dead. The stinker of the week for this week in DVDs is Before I Go to Sleep, a bad movie with Nicole Kidman playing a woman with amnesia. I kind of want to forget this movie after seeing it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Jupiter Ascending, Seventh Son, and the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.